Mile from 10, my musical theme centres on aspects of dawn. After 11, my concerto for two violins is by Sir Malcolm Arnold, and I've Ravel's Mameloi, Mother Goose, played by the pianists Samson Francois and Pierre Barbizet. A highly original rendition, but then you'd expect that from anything Samson Francois is involved with. So, plenty to look forward to, and I look forward to sharing it with you.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
On Friday night, one of the world's great orchestras, the Vienna Philharmonic, comes to the Proms. Lorin Maazel directs them in Anton Bruckner's towering Symphony No. 8, composed as a conscious tribute to three great Austro-German masters. Before that, we'll hear music by J.S. Bach, played on Bruckner's own organ, which still towers over every prom in the Royal Albert Hall. Join me, Donald MacLeod, for The Proms, live from the Royal Albert Hall, Friday night at 7:30, here on BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms.
And now, Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest today is the dancer and choreographer Gillian Lynn.
Gillian Lynn is best known now as a choreographer of a string of West End and Broadway hits, including Cats and The Phantom of the Opera. She received a Lifetime Olivier Award earlier this year, but she's had an extraordinarily varied career as a dancer, a television director, a director of musicals, and as a film star who seduced Errol Flynn, of which more, much, much more later. I can't possibly list all you've done, Gillian. I have actually got a CV here which runs for many pages. Marvellous productions. Almost impossible to believe. But you actually started dancing professionally before the war.
Oh, yes. I was so dedicated and so mad about it. There was a dearth, you know, the war was brewing and things like that. So people were going off into the services and stuff. And so I think they were looking in areas that they would never have looked. And somebody saw this funny little thing who was talented. And I was 14 when I actually started professionally.
One thing I think drove you on was really a terrible tragedy that happened just around that time, just before, in fact.
Yes, Mummy was killed in a small Fiat with three other women, the four of them killed straight out because they skidded into an oncoming petrol tanker. It was a terrible, terrible tragedy. And then right on top of that came the war. So for 6 months, I didn't have any dancing. And then I ran away from boarding school where I'd been sent and managed to get to a theatre school. And then I started almost immediately being a little pro.
Very difficult thing to get over. So maybe that made you focus on your work as a way of kind of compartmentalising it.
Well, Mummy had been very keen on my work and had induced the absolute necessity for discipline in a dancer's life. So I was very much into what she had laid down for me and what she wanted. I was anyway, but when she was killed, in fact, my whole life really, but certainly my career has been to try to please her and hope that, in fact, I mentioned her on my acceptance speech at Covent Garden a month ago when I got this wonderful award. I said, it's for her. Wish it was. And, you know, that's been all my life. It's all been for her.
I think your first music comes from the time when you were spotted as a dancer and became quite quickly a leading soloist at Sadler's Wells. It's Foray, the first violin sonata.
I loved the music and it was a lovely story and the entire thing was magic, so that's stuck in my brain forever.
He's quite an individual composer. I mean, in many ways understated, but also memorable.
I think he's the understated I like because it isn't understated and fairly regular, is it? It goes off at wonderful tangents and I love his choice of keys. They're always never quite what you thought they would be and I love that. I think that shaped very much what I like to do when I'm choreographing now. And so Well, fabulous.
Part of the first movement of Faure's Violin Sonata No. 1 in A Major Opus 13, played by Krzysztof Rostostowicz with Susan Tomes playing the piano. You've written about your wartime experience, Gillian Lynn, a dancer in wartime, And I can't resist asking you about the feelings you must have had dancing during the war with bombs, doodlebugs falling all around you.
You know, it's an awful thing to admit, but it was exciting for us. I mean, I was very young. So several things were happening. I'd lost my mum. My dad was all but lost. He was a major in the army. And suddenly I had a family again. And the danger and the falling of the bombs seemed a bit more theatricality. It's more like a lumber theatre.
I suppose if you know that at any moment you could be wiped out, you'd live life at with a certain extra degree of adrenaline and buzz, really.
I think so. And, you know, we were very aware, not as aware as we should have been, obviously, about what was happening. As we went off on the ENSA tours, then we got much more aware. But, you know, I witnessed England put itself together. I heard those wonderful speeches by Winston, which, you know, were wonderful. So it was such a fertile time in many ways. It sounds funny to say that about a war, but England, which I think is a lazy country, but I watched England say, oh, my God, we haven't got this, we haven't got that, they've got it, it's coming, it's dropping on us. We'd better pull up our socks, we'd better brush ourselves down and start all over again. I witnessed that. That was terribly exciting.
And this piece evokes that period. It is the film that, for many people, epitomises it.
I think, as a country, we needed to embrace a tune and say, this is ours for the war, and that was it.
The Warsaw Concerto from Dangerous Moonlight.
Yes.
Music from the film Dangerous Moonlight, Richard Adinsel's Warsaw Concerto. We heard Martin Roscoe playing the piano, and the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra was conducted by Ruman Gamba. At that time, Gillian Lynn, you found yourself quite soon with Ninette de Valois, and she was pretty hard on her dancers, wasn't she?
So everybody but me thought. I mean, famous dancers, you know, some of the ballerinas, not Margot, went a little on about Ninette and thought that she was too tough. But I absolutely loved the woman. She was witty and clever and powerful and brave. It's the bravery I loved about her. And I didn't care if she was strong, and I knew I was learning.
I wonder if this actually echoes something you said just now, which was that in this country was slightly easy come, easy go in terms of discipline, especially in terms of the arts, I think. I mean, in the same way that Scholte seized the orchestra of the Royal Opera House by the neck and shook it, there was a much more concentrated form of discipline on the continent at that time.
Yes. Indeed. I mean, she had to mastermind the business side of it. We knew that the money coming in was rather going a little bit more to the opera than to us, and we were all up in arms about that. So Ninette had to deal with that. She had to find a company where really there weren't a lot of people. She's a wonderful choreographer. So she mounted some of her own ballets in the midst of it. She was trying to improve all of us. Yes, she was disciplined, but if she really gave you a massive dressing down, there was always something witty at the end, and you couldn't help but laugh, you know.
There was a certain business acumen because she founded by Royal Charter the governors of the Royal Ballet because she foresaw that when the two companies were slightly up against each other, opera and ballet for funds, which of course they notably are, there would need to be somebody to fight the corner of the Royal Ballet.
Yes, I mean, and no better person. No better. She's quite simply one of the most wonderful people I ever met in my life, and I have tried to follow her example.
And you're still quite strict with yourself in terms of daily...
I'm horribly strict. I wouldn't be still doing it, would I, if I wasn't strict? And I'm very strict with people that work with me, and they know it's going to be strict. But in the end, I sort of always gabble on the fact that I liked it, because then you know where you are as an actor and a singer and a dancer. If you've got someone who can't make their mind up and is all soft and willowy, it's not as good as to have somebody who says, this is what we're going to do.
And also the ability to show people things which they think might not be possible. I remember, it's all like Britain. Once somebody said they couldn't play something on a string instrument, on the violin or the viola, and he picked it up and played it. And you, I've watched you rehearse. You've been able to do that, haven't you?
Yes, you see, that's why I keep doing my work out now at this ancient age, because I've got to be able to do that. Otherwise, I feel a failure. And sometimes, you know, you're making up something original and weird, and so you can't ask somebody else to do it because it's in here. You've got to do it yourself.
Do you think to a certain extent that you brought classical ballet training into West End musicals? Aspects of it?
Very much so. I did, because I think that's what's exciting. The mixture of classical and jazz and contemporary, that's what excites me.
Tell me about Vaughan Williams and why you chose it.
Well, I was awfully lucky early on to be cast in the wonderful ballet of Job, choreographed by Ninette de Valois, who wasn't just the great maker of the Sadler's Wells Ballet. However, she was one of the best choreographers they've ever had. And I was so carried away, I was so happy that I was in the ballet, that I was doing Ninette's work, that this ravishing music happened. And we were doing something where we had to move our arms quite a lot in the air, and suddenly there was a clap, and she stopped, and she said, Lynn, because we're always called by our surnames, Lynn, there is no need to give us your entire soul. A simple smile will do. Well, of course, everybody fell apart, and so I always remember that as a wonderful occasion. It's so wonderfully cruel and powerful.
I wish everybody could have seen your enactment of Satan's movements there.
Well, you see, I wanted to do that. That's what I didn't want to be an angel, really. I mean, I was quite proud, but, oh, that dance.
Were you an angel in real life at that time?
No, I've never been an angel. No, Ninette used to call me the rebel. No, I wasn't, I'm afraid.
Well, that was Satan's Dance of Triumph from Vaughan Williams' Job, A Mask for Dancing, London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. We're having music of a particular period, rather naturally, because at that time, and it doesn't happen quite so much now, the leading composers of the day, I'm thinking of Britten Tippett, Lennox Barkley, my father, Walton, all wrote both for film and for dance in a way that they don't so much now.
No, they don't, do they?
It's rather sad.
It is sad.
And in fact, the next piece is Walton. This is from a ballet called The Quest, choreographed by Fred Ashton in 43. Everybody was charmed by him, weren't they?
Very much so. But he, Willie, he didn't happen to like this score. He wasn't mad about it. Whereas, well, I certainly was mad about it. It's very theatrical, like all his stuff. But there were two men, both he and Frederick Ashton, Sir Fred, who were both the epitome of charm. It was very heady wine with them around.
There wasn't much point in you ladies being keen on Ashton.
No. Some very famous ladies tried, hung out, put on drapey, interesting dresses and hung about and brought him champagne and he couldn't have been more lovely with them. But no, they didn't get anywhere.
Although you were a naughty angel, you were still at that point quite a virginal one, weren't you?
I was totally virginal. I was. My mother had told me I had to remain a virgin until I got married. And then she was killed, and so I couldn't argue. But it was terrible not to be able to argue, so I hung on like grim death. And then when I finally did marry, and it lasted 5 years, sadly.
So your mum's advice you would not actually pass on now to anybody?
I certainly wouldn't, though I'm not mad about the way everybody leaps into the sack at the drop of a hat now, either. I wonder where romance has gone, and dating, and secret smile, and a searching of the eyes. Where's all that gone? It's gone to that.
Well, maybe that's why it's a rather good moment to have music from The Quest. Tell us about the bit you've chosen, which I think is near the Palace of Pride, this scene.
And it was my first role where I was kind of picked out. It was one of those moments when you know you've done something that makes them look at you differently. I knew I'd taken a step up. And, well, you're here, there is what I call a moving waltz in the middle of it, which I think is Walton at his best. But, you'll see it's worth it, I think.
Thank you.
that waltz is so moody. And we had a lot of quick runs on point and a lot of spiky stuff, but then we had skimming jumps. So to take off and skim through the air to that waltz was a piece of cake. It was wonderful.
That was the scene near the Palace of Pride from the ballet The Quest by William Walton, and we heard the English Northern Philharmonia conducted by David Lloyd-Jones. Some of these recordings are a little obscure, but the details, if you want to find them, are on our Private Passions page on the Radio 3 website. Gillian Lynn, you danced in the first season at Covent Garden after the war, February 1946, first in Sleeping Beauty, and then to this music, César Franck's Symphonic Variations.
It is a terrific piece, and I think Fred had been brooding about it for some time, and it was almost the first thing, in fact, I think it was the first ballet, he went into after we'd opened this glorious opening to reopen the opera house.
And suddenly you could have an orchestra again. People could dust off their evening clothes.
Yes, and a few people had come back from the war. Some of the good men had managed to get out of the army and Air Force and everything by then. And Ninette was finding a better calibre of people to join. So Fred could attempt this ballet, which was not easy at all.
Thank you.
Well, so many memories with that, of course.
It's a small group of dancers who are on stage for the entire piece, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes, originally we had to be sewn in. They sewed our shoes and they sewed our hooks and eyes. Because in case during the double work, during the pas de deux, you did it. We did lots of fast pirouettes and finished in a big back bend. And that impact is quite tough. And you can very easily unstitch. And then nobody could go into the wings and get anything put right. So they sewed us in. And can I quickly tell you, we were doing it in Prague. And we all had got diarrhoea because of the, I don't know where we'd been, to a banquet or something, but we were all suffering. And we were absolutely terrified because we thought, how will we get through 17 minutes? And then we've got to be unsewn. So we did it, and unfortunately, or fortunately, the Prague audiences loved it and threw bales of roses onto the stage. And we were in agony, and then we said to them, don't do another curtain, for God's sake. And then we ran full pelt with our dressers following. And the dressers were literally having to
unpick
tear.
You.
Yes.
What a nightmare.
Oh, dear, yes. And it was so opposite from the cool and beautiful thing we just performed. It was very funny.
The opening we heard there of César Franck's Symphonic Variations for Piano and Orchestra, Pascal Roger played the piano, and the London Festival Orchestra was conducted by Ross Popel. After the war, Gillian, you danced in a film with Errol Flynn, the master of Ballantrae, and you became a film star.
No, I didn't star. I was like number three.
You made quite an impact, though.
Well, I had a funny face.
I've had a look at it again. You're a gypsy temptress.
Yes.
And there's certainly...
Sexy Tortugan girl, they referred to me as.
Right. And certainly a degree, if I put it this way, of sexual chemistry between you and Errol Flynn. And it wasn't just for the cameras, was it?
No. It was impossible, in a way, not to have a feeling like that for Errol, because in spite of the fact people are sometimes so rude about it, and in fact, a lot of the interviews I had to give afterwards, the opening gambit was often, I expect you spent the whole time running around the bed, which I found really horrible, and said so. And I said, not at all. You know, Errol is very intelligent, which he was. He was the first person that got me into a lot of reading, a lot of novels. And he also taught me how to act. I mean, I was absolutely green and used to acting huge roles, very dramatic, on Covent Garden stage. This was filming. So he taught me, literally taught me.
And you did have a happy time with him for a while.
Very. Very. And we wrote to each other until he died, which he died horribly young, 44, I think. It was the demon drink, of course.
There were so many rumours about him, but did you find him just a very straightforward lover, as it were?
I found him a wonderful workmate. And, no, I'll never remember him as a great lover. I mean, he was a very, very beautiful man, but by the time one got into anything like the end of the day... That had gone on a bit.
The drinking.
A bit of the drinking, yes.
Yeah.
But a beautiful man he was, highly intelligent, very witty, and very generous.
You've chosen some Errol Garner, some jazz next.
Ah, well, I had a wonderful time. I just started choreographing, and Elizabeth West, who ran a lovely little ballet company, came to me and Dudley Moore quite separately, and said, I want you to write, in our various capacities, a jazz ballet. It's time a jazz ballet happened in England, and there's never been one, and there's nothing. I adored Dudley Moore, one of the great, brilliant performers of all time. But then that started a long friendship and collaboration. We did a couple of reviews together, and then we were both unhappy in our love life, and we used to share all those thoughts, and we somehow, that led to wanting ourselves to make a ballet group, which did say you can do classical and you can do jazz in the same company with the same group of people. And we made a show called Collage. His absolute mentor, if you like, was Errol Garner. And so I then did a ballet called I'll Remember April because of that. And it shaped everything I've done because his timings are weird and offbeat, which Dudley wanted to teach me. About that technique, then.
Fantastic technique. Errol Garner in I'll Remember April.
And Dudley was a very complex person, yeah. But so adorable.
Have you ever heard the when they conjured up, he and Peter Cook, Britain and Piers singing? That's a wicked.
Wicked. But then, and when he was sending me music, they were doing Beyond the Fringe on Broadway by then, and he used to send music through the post that I was waiting to choreograph the next thing to. And then always at the end, he did a really naughty little piece of music. I can't even tell you what the titles were, but they were all naughty. And then he would just improvise brilliantly. Yeah.
Could you tell us one of them, the least naughty one? Well, the most naughty one.
I think the naughtiest one was Coda Cunnilingus. He was like the end of his tether then, and I was a bit like that, having waited for this music, and of course I was in hysterics, because it was brilliant, like everything he did.
So you moved effortlessly, given the musical accompaniment you were being provided, to being a director and choreographer. What, for you, is the process of being inspired by a piece of music? How do you work? Do you listen over and over? Do you start dancing in your room?
I have very early on a mental picture, which is constructed by the music and the emotion of it, turns into the idea of steps. But then if there's money in the production, I always ask for a girl and a boy, and I do pre-work in order to find my style for that particular production.
So you kind of sculpt on them?
Absolutely, you do.
I mean, do you have any form of notation? Or
no, I just have the most weird scribblings, which mean an awful lot to me and not a lot to other people.
You had a relationship, a very close one in some ways, I imagine, with a man that I used to know and love, actually, which was Sir Michael Tippett, because you did the ritual dances in A Midsummer Marriage for him. And I think you even asked him to change one or two things.
I did. I was so thrilled about getting the chance to do this really difficult opera at Covent Garden. And it was beloved Colin Davis conducting it. And there are these amazing ritual dances, and the scenario of them is difficult. It's interesting, and it's all about the hunter and the hunted, and it's always the woman who is the huntress, not the man, and so on. But they are difficult.
And interesting from a gay man to have written that.
Very, very. And I went to Colin, I hope it's all right to say this, you can cut it if it isn't, one day, and I said, you know, it's so hard to get the inner truth of this. I've tried and I can't really. And as far as I can see, I sort of think, I can only think, it's about orgasms. And Colin said, waving his, of course it is, of course it is, you're right.
But well, then, I could see Tippett saying that too, actually.
Well, so then... As it was established that the themes were not easy, especially of the ritual dances, and I had an idea and I wanted to add two characters, which I thought would make the whole storytelling easier. They said, you can't go and ask Sir Michael Tippett to put in two extra. What are you talking about? And I said, but I know I can make it better if I can have these two extra. So I marched up the stores, because he happened to be in this day, and sat at his feet and said what I've just said to you, and I said, I just know if I can have these two characters, and I told him what they'd be, I'll do a better job. Or could you, Michael, nail the scenario for me in simple words? And he said, I've never known what it's about myself. He said, I'd love you to try. I'd love you to add two extra pieces. I'm sure they'll be good. And so he allowed it. So the whole of the Opera House staff, except for Colin, were really quite livid about this. But in the end, it turned out to be the best choreography I've ever done in my life.
Thank you. Fire in Summer, one of the ritual dances in Act Three of Michael Tippett's The Midsummer Marriage. Joan Carlyle, Alberto Remedios, and the chorus and orchestra of the Royal Opera House Covent Garden, conducted by Sir Colin Davis. It's interesting, Gillian Lynn, that for the choreographer of shows like Cats and The Phantom of the Opera, you've actually chosen music from earlier in your career. Music, I think, which you've tended to dance yourself.
I loved my days as a dancer. In fact, I was a bit miffed when I became a choreographer because I got so busy immediately. And I thought I could sort of do both, you know. Well, it's very, very difficult. And I have been so busy all my life.
But you thrived on it.
Well, I did thrive on it.
I mean, you look middle-aged, but in fact you're 87 now and still working. Will you ever stop?
I daren't stop now, Michael. If I stop, I shall keel over.
And how about your home life? I mean, you were married briefly in, I think, 48. Then you've been single. But so I suppose it's probably just not time when you're as busy as you are.
There wasn't time, and I was very choosy, and I wanted to find a real love. I was a bit naughty, but I had high standards. I had high standards of what... I'm a total and utter stupid romantic. Even now, I'm absolutely and utterly a romantic. So I was never going to get married again unless I was besotted about the person. When we were going to do a brand new production of My Fair Lady, Sir Cameron McIntosh gave a meet and greet party at Drury Lane, and I was already doing, as I've said earlier on, my pre-work in the basement. Looked like death, was wet and awful, dirty old practice clothes. And Sir Cameron came and said, for God's sake, can't you stop for a minute and come up and say at least hello to everybody? And so I said, oh, all right. So I went up to the bar looking like the back of Beyond, really, and I saw this gorgeous-looking man standing, leaning against the bar. We took one look, and we're still together. We married in 1980, and we've been together for, I think it's 35 years. He's 27 years younger than I am. He's a lovely actor and singer, and we have found an unconditional love, which is so rare, isn't it? And it's what I always wanted, and I began to think it was absolutely and utterly impossible to find.
That's very happy news for anyone listening to this programme to hear that resolution. And it'd be nice possibly, in fact, I think you must finish with him singing.
Well, could we? Is that allowed?
Yes, absolutely. What would you like?
Thank you. Well, in 86, just before Phantom, I choreographed and directed a brand new production of Cabaret. Peter, my husband, by then sometime, played Cliff. And there is a song that Cliff sings when Liza is fast asleep on their bed, on their one little bed. And he sings this song. So I thought we should hear that.
Well, we will. And Gillian Lynn, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
Why should I wake up? This dream is going so well. When you're enchanted, why break the spell? Drifting in this euphoric state, morning can wait. Let it come late. Why should I wake up? Why waste a drop of the wine? Don't I adore you, and aren't you mine? Maybe I'll someday be lonely again. Why should I wake up till then?
Peter Land singing Why Should I Wake Up from the musical Cabaret, with music by John Kander and lyrics by Fred Ebb. Michael Barclay was talking to Gillian Lynn, and you can download that programme and others in the series. Simply go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Michael's guest next week is the philosopher Angie Hobbs. Private Passions was produced by Elizabeth Burke, and the series is a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3.
Paris comes to the BBC Proms. Paavo Järvi conducts the Orchestre de Paris in Arvo Pärt's Cantus in Memory of Benjamin Britten. And Janine Jansen is the soloist in Britten's Meditative Violin Concerto. Plus two French showpieces in the second half, Berlioz's overture Le Corsaire and Saint-Saëns' Organ Symphony. From Estonian introspection to Gallic flamboyance, join Martin Handley at the Proms tonight at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3 is on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. One of British television's most popular broadcasters and political interviewers, Sir David Frost, has died of a heart attack. He was 74 and died last night on the Queen Elizabeth cruise ship, where he was due to give a speech. In the 1960s, Sir David presented That Was the Week That Was, which satirised the British establishment and politicians for the first time on television, and the current affairs show, The Frost Programme. Later, The David Frost Show was launched in the United States, and it was there he achieved one of journalism's biggest ever exclusives, a series of interviews with the former American President Richard Nixon, in which Richard Nixon apologised for the Watergate scandal. Sir David Frost returned to British television, interviewing prime ministers and world leaders for many years. David Cameron paid tribute, describing him as a fearsome interviewer who made a huge impact on television and politics. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has said that if the US Congress backs President Obama in launching strikes against Syria, he doesn't believe MPs will be asked again to consider military intervention. Mr. Obama announced last night that he would ask politicians in Washington for their support. Mr. Hague said Parliament had spoken and it wasn't realistic for the government to return there every week with the same question. He also accused Labour of behaving opportunistically in Thursday's Commons vote and said there was serious concern in Europe and America about the opposition's position on Syria. The former South African president, Nelson Mandela, has been discharged from hospital in Pretoria, where he'd been treated for a recurring lung infection since June. The South African government said that his condition remained critical, but at times unstable, and that Mr. Mandela would receive the same level of intensive care at his home in Johannesburg. The Japanese authorities have warned that radiation levels around a leaking tank at the Fukushima nuclear plant are 18 times higher than originally thought. The plant's operator says readings taken near the leaking tank show that the radiation is enough to prove lethal within 4 hours of exposure. And the weather, it'll be a fine and dry afternoon, especially in the south, but there'll be occasional rain over Scotland and it'll be windy in northeastern areas. BBC News and Weather at 1:03. And time now for the early music show. Lucy Skeeping picks highlights from a festival which took place in Warsaw last November.
In today's programme, Mazovia goes baroque. Granted, that's probably not a phrase you hear very often, but each winter, this large area of central Poland plays host to a series of early music concerts under that title, and eminently suited it is because it's steeped in history, sprinkled all about with castles, cathedrals and picturesque villages, remnants of the kingdoms and dukedoms that originally divided the region. At the centre, though, is the city of Warsaw, and it's here that the concerts we're here today were recorded at the Lutosławski Polish Radio Studio. We're dipping into four of the best for highlights from various ensembles. Vivaldi, Castaldi and Nicola Matthias are all on the menu, and towards the end we've even managed to squeeze in a couple of pieces which, although not exactly baroque, provide not-to-be-missed performances. Music from 14th century France by Guillaume de Machaut and a raunchy interpretation of a Bulgarian folk song played on the mandolin, which owes more than a little to rock, if not baroque. And it's with that instrument we kick off today's proceedings, with a mandolin sonata by Vivaldi. The two rather dashing players are both Israeli-born. Avi Avital, the first ever mandolin player to receive a Grammy nomination, is accompanied on the harpsichord by Shalev Ad-El. Vivaldi's Mandolin Sonata in C.